Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson is an activist, an environmentalist, and an actor. He won an Emmy for his role as Woody the Bartender in the television series Cheers. He's played starring roles in dozens of hit films, including the Hunger Games series. And he's been nominated for 2 Academy Awards and 2 Golden Globe Awards. Woody is a passionate animal advocate and an environmentalist. My dad and I got to work with him on a series of events about 10 years ago where he was touring the United States in a hemp oil-fueled biodiesel bus. Woody's co-owner of Sage, which is the world's first vegan beer garden, and co-founder of Prairie Paper Ventures. It's a tree-free paper company that manufactures paper from agricultural waste. And just recently, on March 29th, Woody received an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters degree from Hanover College. So now, Woody, my dad and I are so grateful to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean. And yes, welcome, Woody. It's wonderful to be with you again.
Oh, thanks. What a pleasure. I really do love you guys. And, John, you've been such a great, bright, shining light and a beacon for so many of us who've been trying to find our way in this area of vegan food. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Woody, and likewise to you. I know many people you've inspired to eat more healthfully and take their lives more seriously in terms of their impact on the environment, and it's a pleasure to talk with you always.
Well, thank you.
And I want to ask you about your journey around food. I know that, like a lot of us, at one point you ate burgers and steaks and ice cream and the usual array of processed food-like substances that our food environment is so full of. A lot of people today are still in the habit of buying junk fast foods that have no actual food in them. Eating crap is so common in our society that we often don't see how disempowering it is. Can you tell us what you eat now and what the change to healthy eating has meant to you?
Well, you know, one of the things I meant to say when I received my honorary doctorate the other day, which I failed to, was just to say, look, you guys, you know, I do believe in balance. I mean, I'm not always the most balanced guy, but the point being that if you're going to pursue a life of partying and drinking and whatever else, you're going to have to give up the meat and dairy. I meant to say it in a way that would have made them laugh, you know, but in fact, it's true. For me, you know, my life, I was in such a full tilt boogie situation that if I had not shifted to eating well, I don't know what would have become of me, because it really, it's such a major tax to eat heavy, dense food. And I really feel like right now I'm in the best, you know, state with the food, because I eat mostly raw and I do get a lot of enzymes. I just feel like that's a big component of the food that people don't talk about, you know, or that a lot of talk about protein, carbohydrates and fats and so forth. But people aren't talking enough about enzymes, and the enzymes being the life force of the food, I think it's a really crucial thing.
Foods that are high in life force are really wonderful. I always feel it's a privilege to be able to eat healthy foods in their natural state. Do you find that eating the way you do, natural foods without any meat or dairy products, gives you more energy for life and on the set?
Yeah, well, there's no question about it. Almost every person on the set experiences this thing of, you know, the after lunch slowdown. Just understood. The crew's going to move slower, the actors, and everybody's going to move slower after lunch. And for me, even though I've been vegan a long time, I've still had that slowdown until I decided, okay, I'm just going to have raw food, especially when I'm on set. But I've been doing this experiment so long with myself where I'll have periods of eating cooked food. Now, I know you eat cooked food and Ocean eats cooked food, and so I'm not trying to sit here and lecture you guys, because I eat cooked food too, but having done the experiment a lot, I really see the effect of when I'm eating a lighter raw food fare and when I'm not. It's like my energy doesn't flag, you know, from when I wake up until I go to bed. I just have a very constant stream of good energy. So, I don't know. A lot of times I'll overeat. But either way, you know, when I eat cooked food, I do get slowed down for a while. And sometimes it's a hell of a thing to get kicked back into gear.
I think most of us overeat at times or eat foods that aren't the best for us. Part of the problem has been that up until recently, people who ate natural foods and people who didn't eat meat or dairy products were often viewed as marginal. But recently, we've seen both Bill Clinton and Al Gore become vegans.
I didn't know that about Al Gore, although someone had mentioned it, but I never heard that. And the last time I saw him, he was eating steak, but that was, that must have been 3 years ago now, so.
Gore's been vegan now for about a year, and it seems to be very good for him. He's lost a lot of weight that he needed to lose. And he's recently said that it's working so well for him that he expects to remain vegan for the rest of his life. I haven't agreed with everything about his politics or his lifestyle, but I do admire his efforts to raise awareness about global warming. And I'm glad to see him modeling a healthy lifestyle and enjoying its benefits.
That's wonderful. I have such high regard for Al Gore and everything he's done, particularly since leaving office. So, boy, it'd be great for him to be around for a while and to carry on with good energy.
Not everyone realizes that eating a vegan diet, as Al Gore and Bill Clinton are now doing, is probably the single most powerful step most of us can take to fight climate change. Woody, you've been eating a diet that's good for you and good for the earth for a long time. As we speak, you're on the set making the third and fourth films in the Hunger Games series. Has it gotten any easier for you to get healthy food while making movies? And what are you eating these days as you make these very popular films?
Well, I usually have someone chefing, but I really like a light fare. Like I'll have like a nice sprout salad. And then I'll have maybe some cool raw bread with tomatoes and avo and maybe also some microgreens on top, you know, with a good sauce. So that'll be it, just the salad and then the other thing, which is a little bit more chewy and gives you the texture and as well as the taste. When you think about it, that's all food is, texture, taste. If you can accomplish those things without eating things that are going to just drag you down and also be bad for the environment, you know, why wouldn't you go that way? And I think a lot of people are doing that now. I see it really changing, and our place, Sage, is full all the time, and it's great. There's a shift taking place for sure, and you were right at the beginning of it. Must be awesome for you to look. I wonder how it is for you to look at it now.
I feel a deep sense of gratitude to have been allowed to play a part in the food awakening that is so desperately needed. I feel grateful when I see so many people like you and many of our other speakers in the Food Revolution Summit taking up the cause and helping people to eat in a way that is healthier for their bodies and healthier for the earth and kinder to the animals. I feel grateful to you, and I feel grateful to all of our listeners for every step they take to move in a healthy direction. It's good for each of us, and it also sends so many positive ripples out into the biosphere, ripples of healing into the whole Earth community. So I do feel very grateful to be part of the food revolution. But you know, Woody, I also, to be perfectly frank, I also feel a lot of frustration.
How do you mean?
Well, there is so much more that needs to be done. I love life, and I love this world, and it's frightening to see what we're doing to the life support systems. The amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere is now higher than it has been at any time in the past 800,000 years. Carbon dioxide is, of course, the most important long-lived greenhouse gas responsible for man-made global warming. Every single molecule of carbon dioxide we emit can remain aloft for hundreds of years, which means that the effects of today's industrial and agricultural activities will be felt for the next few centuries, possibly for thousands of years. The oceans have been absorbing some of our carbon dioxide emissions, with the result that they're now more acidic than at any time in the past million years. At current rates, by 2050, they'll be more corrosive than at any time in the past 20 million years. We're really changing this planet. At this moment, every major glacier on Earth is shrinking. In 20 years, those in Montana's Glacier National Park will be gone entirely. Within a decade, there'll be no ice at the North Pole in the summer, just open ocean. By the end of this century, if we don't change our ways, the Earth will be the hottest it has been in more than 2 million years, which is maybe 10 times longer than human beings have even existed on this planet. It's mind-boggling, and it can be frustrating to watch our politicians do nothing. It's as though we're intent on sleepwalking over a cliff. We need to go into fossil fuel rehab. We need to create a post-carbon economy. We need to eat far less meat. And we need to raise awareness about the damage we're doing, which I know you do as often as you can, Woody. What do you think, Woody? Do you see people becoming more aware? Do you think we'll somehow be able to summon the political will to turn the tide?
The global warming thing is interesting because now everybody's aware of it. No one, you know, there are some people who just have their head in the sand who maybe don't acknowledge it, but pretty much everybody acknowledges it. People who aren't going to acknowledge it are going to be somehow connected to the industries that are creating it or connected as politicians, but no one else is, you know, we can all feel that there's a difference happening. We know that the ice is melting all over the world, and we know that all kinds of mad stuff as a result of global warming is happening. And yet, the weird thing is, in spite of this awareness, there isn't really the change that needs to happen in all these industries, particularly the petroleum and coal. You know, they're still doing what they're doing. There's still mountaintop removal happening as fast as they can, and it's all still happening. And so there's never going to be the political will to change that, because that's like asking a puppet to scold the marionette, you know? Tell the marionette to change. You got to cut the strings between the puppet and the marionette, but I don't know that it's going to come from politicians.
Cutting the strings would mean reducing corporate control over our politicians and our policies. I would like to see a constitutional amendment that would establish that money is not speech, and that human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. I'd like to see us remember that it's we the people, not we the corporations. In the food world, that would mean agricultural policies that support food that is healthy for people and healthy for the biosphere. But now, we too often have policies that are only healthy for the bottom line of companies, like Monsanto and Coca-Cola, Cargill and McDonald's. You are, as we speak, on the set shooting the Hunger Games. Some people see the Hunger Games as a parable for our time, as a warning about the direction our society is going. Do you think of the Hunger Games as just a fantasy, or as saying something important about our world and our possible future?
To me, there's no question that that's what Suzanne Collins intended. It's really analogous to where we are now and to our plight. It's very obvious for anyone who looks at it closely and who has any awareness of what's going on in society, but it certainly is all of these giant corporations and industries that are controlling all of us. It's not a pretty thing, you know, where we're headed because of it.
In The Hunger Games 2, Catching Fire, your character, Haymitch, says at a very, very key moment, your job is to be a distraction so people forget what the real problems are. That line of yours sent shivers up my spine, Woody. What does that statement mean to you when you reflect on today's world and this moment in history?
Well, I do think that a lot of what's in the media is distraction. I'm not saying that it's, you know, necessarily a thing where the media decides, let's distract them. You know, it might be the people who own the media don't even know. But I think there's obvious members of the media who don't even need to be named, who are doing everything they can to misinform the people toward certain ends. You open a magazine and you have 30 pages about what people are wearing and what's hot and what's not. And I think to myself, where's the section on what's going on ecologically? I mean, here we all are perched on this ledge. Like you said, we're like lemmings. It's like we have the same awareness as the lemmings, which is we don't know that we're about to go over a cliff. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of distraction going on, and what really matters is not at the forefront of the media. And you would think, because the media is generally all about stories that make you sad and stories that make you feel bad, they'd be all over this ecological stuff.
Well, the media does like stories that make us afraid and that make us feel powerless. But I don't think they want to really inform us and support a viable democracy, because the news media are themselves owned by corporations that profit from our ignorance and our apathy. They don't want us to know which foods contain GMO ingredients, for example, because then we might not buy them. They want us to, as your character Hamish so aptly puts it, forget what the real problems are. Woody, what are the real problems today? What do you think we as a society need to pay attention to if we're going to wake up and deal with reality?
Well, John, I'll tell you, I think we really have to look at our energy. And that means both our energy on a personal level, in terms of what we eat and what are the implications of what we eat ecologically. And we also have to look on a global level where we're getting our energy from. And all of these things like mountaintop removal and fracking and all these oil spills and the nuclear disasters, I mean, all of these things have a connection. They're all about our energy, and they're all illustrating for us that we're getting our energy from the wrong source. And I suppose maybe not everybody can afford solar panels, but I know that if the subsidies, if the solar industry got even, you know, 1/100th of the subsidy that all these other industries do, it could make it so that people could afford that. If we put in place the ability for bad practices to be taxed accordingly and good practices to be given tax breaks, which you see to some degree. But, for example, that happened with the solar in L.A. Initially in California. You got these tax incentives. Well, those disappeared very shortly. But, you know, the subsidies to these giant corporations that are putting us where we are ecologically, their subsidies never seem to end. So, I don't know. What's to be done? I think there has to be some way that those people doing good are rewarded and those people doing bad are penalized. But how are you going to get that to happen in a society where the body politic completely kowtows to the giant industries? I don't see how you're going to have that happen.
Our subsidies, our tax incentives, certainly are at present perverse. We subsidize oil, as you say, far more than solar or wind. We subsidize industrial meat and GMOs far more than we support farmers' markets or fresh produce. I'd like to see us reverse those incentives. I'd like to see us tax the use of pesticides, for example, and use that revenue to lower the price to the consumer of organic food. I'd like to see us tax food with added sugars, like soda pop, and use the income stream from that to lower the price that people pay for fresh fruits and fresh vegetables.
Well, that's a good example.
Woody, I'm thinking of another key moment in The Hunger Games 2, Catching Fire, where your character, Haymitch, says, "Remember who the real enemy is." It's a key line in the film. Do you have a sense of who or what the real enemy is today?
Well, yeah, of course. In that context, I'm talking about the Capitol. They're really not even, you know, the Capitol as much as President Snow and his kind of governance. Or anyway, Haymitch is talking about that.
Yes.
You know, a lot of times we do. It's so weird how separatism and, you know, all the isms, the nationalism and the various disparity between the religions and the, and even in Christianity, there's like all these different religions that say the Methodists don't think the Baptists are going to get into heaven and the Catholics don't think any of the Protestants are going to get into heaven. And, you know, there's all these weird just separatisms. So I don't know if there's some way that we could kind of settle our differences and just look at who the real problem is. I think we'll find that it's these industries which control these governments, right? In a way, we kind of support that because maybe we buy things from these industries, but we're going to have to figure out where we're going to put our dollar, you know, and start voting with our dollar. And also harness the power of boycott if there's ever going to be any real, genuine change in our society.
Well, I'm always looking for avenues of genuine change, positive change. And I've been thinking a lot lately about the difference between revolution and evolution. This conversation that we're having is part of the Food Revolution Summit, which is put on by the Food Revolution Network. We use the word revolution in this sense because our food system has become so toxic, so dominated by corporate interests, that it is not enough now to tweak it here and there, to tweak it a little bit. It's not enough to deal with symptoms while overlooking causes. We use a word like revolution because we need fundamental changes, guided, we hope, by love, that lead to greater health for each of us and the whole Earth community. On the other hand, though, the concept of revolution that is presented in the Hunger Games is a decidedly violent one. Donald Sutherland, the veteran actor who plays President Snow, the tyrannical president in the Hunger Games, has said that he hopes the Hunger Games will stir up a revolution. I sympathize with Donald Sutherland's feelings. We absolutely need fundamental change. But there's something about the call for the kind of violent revolution that the Hunger Games seems to be about that I find frightening. Sometimes I think we bandy about the word revolution a little too flippantly because we're not taking into account the misery and the suffering that violence often causes. With all due respect to the Hunger Games, maybe we need not so much to revolt as to evolve, not so much to take up arms as to become more powerful people. There's a difference between force and power. We need to fully own our power, but I don't think we do that through violence. Now, I recognize people might disagree with me about this, but here's what I mean. Let's say somebody had a magic wand and could wave it, and instantly the entire Earth would become pristine. All the excess carbon and the other greenhouse gases would be gone from the atmosphere and from the oceans. All the pollution would be gone from the lakes and the rivers and the oceans. Our topsoil would be back. Our air quality would be pure. It would be a beautiful world. But if we hadn't evolved, if we hadn't become more conscious people, more responsible people, then in a few decades or centuries, we would almost certainly just screw it all up again. We'd create what we have in fact created now, a polluted world where the power resides less and less in the hands of the people and more in the hands of the very rich. A world with shrinking civil liberties, expanding corporate influence, and increasing domestic surveillance. A world very much like that depicted in the Hunger Games. This is why I think we need to evolve as people, and why I have misgivings about the kind of violent revolution the Hunger Games seems to be calling for. Woody, have you ever had any experiences in your life that have given you insight into the difference between revolution and evolution?
Well, it's funny, you know, I was in India not a couple of decades ago, I was hanging out with this incredible guy named Swami Chidananda. I was really excited after spending time with him, and I was saying, I'm going to do yoga every day, I'm going to meditate every day, I'm going to do this and that and the other, and he just looks at me and he smiles and he says, evolution, not revolution. And I think that we're going to have to evolve, you know, as a society, and it's happening. You know, you can see where people have, for example, consciousness about global warming, and people have this consciousness about what they eat more so than they ever have in our society, I think. But until we're getting our fuel from the farmer's market, and until we somehow are able to figure out, get together in between us, figure out how we take over some of these industries. I'm not talking about taking it over. I'm talking about individual communities taking over and harnessing the power that that entails and using it for good. I don't know. I'm not really one to, I don't know how everything's going to change, but I know it's only going to change through things like this. You guys have a hell of a network. You know, you have 100,000 people tuning into this. There's so many progressive folks in this country who care about the world at large and care about the environment, you know, and I think when you get all of these like-minded folks together and decide, okay, first thing we have to do is figure out what we're going to do about how we're going to fuel ourselves, how we're going to fuel our homes. That is going to make a huge difference. And then, you know, there's all kinds of other things. There's dealing with Monsanto and all these other corporations that are doing what they're doing. But it's only going to come if we all get together and join forces.
Well, one of the many things I appreciate about you is you're a marvelous actor, of course, and a celebrity, but you are genuinely interested in the world at large. You care about these larger issues, and you show up for them in a big way.
Well, thanks,
John. You now co-own what may be the world's first organic beer garden, the Sage Bistro in Culver City.
I think it is the first.
Tell us about the bistro.
There's this girl that I know named Molly Angelhart who has a restaurant called Sage, but it's more in the east part of L.A. She wanted to open this beer garden. She told me about it. I said, phenomenal idea. And keep in mind, this is an unusual family. We all have a Maui connection. We all know each other through Maui. But anyway, her brothers and her father are the people who started Cafe Gratitude. So they know what they're doing. And so it was just me deciding to partner with her. And she did everything. I just put up money.
You mentioned Maui. You and your wife, Laura, have an organic farm in Maui.
It's actually, it's beyond organic. It's biodynamic.
And what kinds of foods are you growing there now?
There's probably no fruit you could mention that we don't have. I mean, we have like 6-7 different types of avocado. You know, we have tons of coconut trees. We have Rellenia. We have pineapples. We have everything. It's just incredible. It's, for a fruit lover, it is paradise for sure. We also have other things. We have ducks and chickens, and we have a lot of things that just helping to re-nitrogenize the soil and fertilize the soil in a natural way. And this is pretty great. It's my idea of heaven.
It sounds heavenly.
I
want to ask you about your Step Forward paper, because I know you're co-owner, I guess, of a company that's producing paper from wheat straw and other agricultural wastes. And what I read is that you have already saved enough trees to stretch 14 times higher than Mount Everest. That's a staggering thing. What's going on here? And what's happening with this tree-free paper revolution?
Well, just to backtrack, you know, it's always been my thing. I don't know, like everybody has their thing. Mine has been more forests. I did protests, and I also put money into a lot of ecological things. People just trying to stop from cutting here or from clear cutting there. But the problem is that if you do stop them here, they'll go somewhere else and they'll still do it. And I started to realize that no matter what I do, even like climbing the Golden Gate Bridge just to try to stop the clear cutting of the ancient redwoods in Northern California, you know, even that, there was some good that came out of it. But in the end, they're going to get what they want, and they're going to get that. It's just a product to them. It doesn't matter if they're going to cut down trees that were here before Jesus to make picnic tables. They're going to do it. It's not like they have some emotional attachment. And understandably, people doing the cutting have mouths to feed. But it just occurs to me that the only way you're going to get real change is to change the way paper is made, because paper constitutes 40% of all trees cut. Now, they cut between 3 and 6 billion trees a year. 40% of that goes to paper. It's not hard to do the math to understand. If you want to protect forests, you got to address the way they're making paper. So that has been my thing for so long, and we started this company 15 years ago, me and my buddy Jeff Golfman, who's a Canadian, ultimately with the concept of getting a mill in Winnipeg. But in the meantime, we're making our paper, which is 80% wheat-based, 20% FSC certified, and that paper's made in India. That's where we had to go to find the mills appropriate for us, you know, like we don't use chlorine or anything. Yeah, so that's going great. Went to a lot of great people in LA, stepped up. The first was the agency I'm with, CAA, and then Lionsgate stepped up, and Participant Media, and, you know, so we've got it through a lot of different places in LA are using it, which is really helpful. But if the paper revolution is going to happen, we're going to need to get that mill going, and then we'll be able to make non-tree paper 100% the same price as they make tree-based paper. So that's where we're at with it, and I'm very excited about it.
If our listeners wanted to get some of that paper, is there a way they could?
Yeah, they can just call Staples and order it if they want the paper. And it's cool because it's the same price as recycled paper, and yet it's 80% wheat. That wheat has already been used by the farmers for food and for whatever they need to plow back in for the integrity of the soil. So it's really a kind of a win-win for the farmers, for the environment, and for people.
And people can get it at Staples. What is it called at Staples?
It's just called Step Forward Paper.
Step Forward Paper. Okay, great.
Yeah.
You know, there's a question I've been wanting to ask you for a long time. You've played so many roles in your movies. You've been a lovable loser here. You've been a psychopath there. Some of your roles are a little scary to me, like the ones you've played in Rampart and Natural Born Killers. What I want to ask you is there something about chaos that feeds your creativity?
Well, you know, John, I'm not one to do this normally, but I was in London one time, and I don't know, it must have been 4 in the morning, and I just couldn't get a ride, so I got a gypsy cab. And I'm talking to the driver, and it wasn't Nigeria, but it was some African nation. And I don't know how we even got on the subject. He said a thing that I found so freeing. Well, you know, I don't know what precipitated this remark, but he said, chaos and creativity go together. If you lose even 1% of your chaos, you lose your creativity. I thought, well, that's the most freeing, important thing anyone's ever said to a guy like me who's got such a massive amount of chaos in his life. And I guess, in a way, I do cultivate it. And I do think that they're connected. You got to have the chaos if you're going to have the creativity.
Well, maybe we will find, we certainly have a lot of chaos in our world. And maybe that will be an opening to some creative response that we'll find together so that we can learn to feed ourselves and each other and create a society that's worthy of the pain that's part of life and worthy of our dreams and worthy of our children's prayers and really the kind of world we want for ourselves and everyone.
Well, that's well stated, John. I really hope that happens. I'm sure dreaming it, and I know you are.
I am, and I know you are. Many of our listeners are, and we come together in that, I think. And it always has seemed to me that one of the most powerful ways that we can inspire others is to model our beliefs by being the healthiest and happiest and most empowered version of ourselves that we can be. And Woody, you practice what you preach. I shouldn't say that because you don't ever preach, but you lead by example. But I mean, you walk your talk. And one of the things I love about you is how you keep an open mind and you question everything. And I personally know many people who have turned to healthier and more earth-friendly ways of life because of you and your example. It's really easy to see why you have been an inspiration to millions and why you are a beloved figure in our world.
Thank you, John. That really means a lot to me, man. Coming from you, it means so much.
Yeah, it's true. I feel it, Woody, and I love you very much.
I love you, too. It's been great talking to you, man, and just keep doing what you're doing because you're making such a huge, important impact on this world. And you sure have been just a beacon of light for me. And just thank you, thank you, thank you.
We've been talking with award-winning actor Woody Harrelson, star in dozens of productions, including The Hunger Games, and owner of Sage Vegan Beer Garden. Woody, as an actor, you're beloved by billions, and as an environmentalist, I think you're beloved by the very future of life. We want to thank you for all the ways that you're using your prominent presence in the world in service to bettering that world, and we want to thank you for your time, for your friendship, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Oh, thank you, Ocean, and thank you for what you're doing, man. Keep it up, brother.
We're doing it together.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get these members-only courses and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. This concludes day 6 in the Food Revolution Summit. We've been talking today with some celebrities. Ultimately, though, the Food Revolution is all about you. To express your opinions on what you've been hearing and to find out what other people are saying, you can post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcast page. Remember, you'll need to refresh the page if you want to see the latest comments. Come back and join us tomorrow for Food Politics. Don't let McDonald's or Coca-Cola or Monsanto control your menu or your country. We'll be hearing from Dr. Robert Lustig on stunning new research that tells us sugar may be more addictive and more deadly than we've ever imagined. We'll also hear from Dr. Marion Nessel on standing up to the food industry, and from Dr. Michael Jacobson, the man who helped bring us nutritional labels in the United States and who may have actually coined the term junk food. So please come on back and join us tomorrow. We wish you health, happiness, and lots of good food.